Welcome to the LTAD Network podcast. I'm your host, Rob Anderson, and on this podcast, we seek out the world's best researchers, coaches, support staff, teachers, and athletes to better understand the process of long-term athlete development. Don't forget to get your 7-day free trial to our online platform and 50% off your first month with the code LTADVIP50. That's LTADVIP50 at the LTAD Network Hub website. This podcast episode is sponsored by Statera. Statera is a web-based application that helps youth athletes and their stakeholders estimate training load, track maturation status, monitor readiness, and manage injury. Put together by coaches working with busy youth athletes, Statera helps keep things simple and brings together the most important training information in one place to ensure that effective athlete-centered decisions can be made. No more complicated Excel tutorials and spreadsheets, just upload your athlete's data and their training schedule and start to take control of their training commitments and workload. Make more informed decisions and protect your athlete's well-being, supporting their performance. Statera takes your data very seriously. GDPR compliant and registered with the ICO, choose from a range of maturation indices and validated measures, or customize your own. Statera can record any training variable and all your data is fully exportable. To reach out today and get a free walkthrough, head over to www.statera.uk. That's STATERA.UK. Welcome to the LTAD Network podcast. Today, I'm speaking with Jake Jennings. Jake is a strength and conditioning coach and applied sports scientist. He has extensive experience within academy team settings and individual sports settings, has worked with athletes, male and female, both developing and elite. Jake has enjoyed a varied career, which has afforded him opportunities to live and work interstate and internationally, having benefited in learning from a range of people across cultures and disciplines in sport. Jake moved to Bendigo, Victoria in 2019 to undertake an industry PhD role with the Bendigo Pioneers, NAB League sides, and La Trobe University, where he's investigating the match play demands of elite junior and senior Australian rules football and characteristics associated with draft success. Jake has held youth development roles that he believes either suit or challenge traditional LTAD models, providing him with a unique ability to blend that approach and drive performance.
So Jake, great to have you on the podcast. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Really looking forward to it. And as I said a little bit earlier offline, James has been sort of reaching out for a little while now. So really good to get online and have a chat.
So before we dive into the main kind of subjects that we want to cover, give us a bit of a background in terms of how did a young Jake Jennings get involved in sport? How did you get bitten by the bug and what kind of developed there?
Yeah, so I'll probably go right back to sort of growing up. So I'm 34 now, so getting on in age, unfortunately. But I grew up in sunny Brisbane, up in Queensland in Australia. And I'm actually, you know, a fairly large family of five kids. So I had two brothers, one older and one younger, and I two younger sisters that came along a little bit later. And I like to think of myself as sort of the brawn and the brains in the family. So my two brothers used to gang up on me a fair bit. So I guess the competitive nature started really early on in my life. I actually grew up playing, I know this is, you know, about AFL today, but I actually grew up playing both rugby and tennis. So I was a fairly good junior, not exceptional. I guess this is a pretty similar story to a lot of people. So I made, you know, youth representative teams in rugby, but I never got any further. I played tennis until I was about 16, and then I had to make the choice as to what I was going to try and pursue. I always had the dream of, you know, as every young kid does, of playing for the Wallabies or whatever. But then through my teens, I sort of an early adulthood, I kind of fell out of love with the sports training side of things, and I'm not sure why. I mean, I went pretty hard early on. And it probably, you know, thinking back now, it might even come down to the old, early specialization type scenario. And so, yeah, I fell out of love with training. I still played sort of socially, played rugby. But I actually fell in love with the strengths training side of things. You know, rugby introduced me to that. And I found I was quite good at that and really interested in that side of things. So that sort of transitioned me into my early days of coaching about at the age of about 22, 23, maybe 21. I was sort of stuffing around at uni still. After school, I went into a Bachelor of Business degree, which was just a bit of a waste of time, but not really getting anywhere. And I decided to do a PT course at TAFE. So I don't know if you guys have an equivalent, but TAFE's like a training college. And back then, PT courses were full time actually for 2 years. So, you know, nothing like the 6 week little rapid courses these days. So that was actually, looking back now, one of the best decisions I made. And I actually learned a hell of a lot. So, as I said, full time, 5 days a week for 2 years, really set me up well for as sort of a mature age student going into a bachelor's degree. And I say mature age, but probably, yeah, I think I was 23. I undertook the bachelor degree in Brisbane, and I PT'd off the back of that during that whole bachelor degree. But I sort of, I figured pretty quickly that I didn't want to work with General Pop as a lot of S&Cs do. So by this time, S&C was becoming a little bit more professional. A lot more professional roles were popping up. It was being recognised. The ASCA had sort of established itself and that kind of thing. So that bachelor's degree for me was a bit of a necessity. And as I said, on top of that, I did PT work, and I also picked up a couple of my first S&C roles. So one was at a prominent Brisbane high school, and one was at a senior soccer club, actually. So both of which for me were incredible learning opportunities. The high school one, I would go in mornings and afternoons, and I was part of a team of S&Cs, and we would deliver S&C sessions to any of the performance teams, but then it was also sort of free rein for other students within the school. So that was incredible learning experience for me with, you know, large numbers of athletes in fairly condensed spaces, you know. And then the soccer club for me was, so that was sort of like a, I guess you'd call it, it was Brisbane Premier League, I guess you'd call it maybe semi-professional or amateur level football here. And that was, again, I had a really accommodating coach that, you know, accommodated my development desires as well, and allowed me to, you know, soccer was a new sport for me as well, but allowed me to deliver an S&C program that really drove, you know, not just the athlete's development, but mine as well from a programming standpoint, exposure to a new sport, and just really allowing me consistent time with the athletes all through pre-season and in season, which is something you quite often you don't get at that level with limited access to athletes. Coaches want as much time as they can. So that was incredible for me. I had 3 years through my bachelor degree, working mornings and afternoons at the school. I'd do uni during the day, and then the soccer club a few nights a week and the weekend. So pretty full on undergrad time. From there, me and my now wife moved to London. Actually, we had 2 years in London, where I did some work for a rugby club, amateur rugby club over there, or semi-pro rugby club, for a season, and also did some teaching aid work, which was really, really good. We could we figured out that you didn't actually need a teaching degree over there to do some teaching aid work. So we picked up some contract work at a few different schools, both me and my wife, which is pretty cool. And we did that just to top up the funds. And then we spent the rest of the, we spent probably close to 6 to 8 months traveling following that. after that, I was really lucky to, timing was perfect. Visa was ending in London. I think it was February 2016. I had interviewed for a role at Aspire Academy. So there was a bit of a Brisbane connection there at Aspire Academy with Alex and Stu were there at the time. So I interviewed, I actually didn't get the role first time round. So I was sort of planning to come back to Brisbane. And then they actually got in touch with me, must have been a couple of months later, and asked if I was still interested. So obviously I jumped at that opportunity. Wife came home to Brisbane and I took off to Aspire. Left London, didn't come home, left London and went straight to Aspire. Spent 2 years there working in the fencing program and, you know, a bit of work across the athletics development programs as well. But that fencing program was a new program within Aspire. So that was a great experience to be able to sort of develop an S&C sort of program curriculum from the ground up in a new sport and a sport that I had, you know, absolutely no exposure to. Most people don't. So that was pretty cool. So I spent 2 years there for a few various reasons. I ended up coming home to Brisbane and I took up a role, athlete development coordinator role at another private school up in Brisbane. So I was there, I was sort of in charge of, it was just me and some students, but there I was in charge of delivering an athlete development program over the full school from years 5 through to 12, and then also in charge of, you know, providing the S&C services for the performance sports as well. So, you know, your typical rugby, basketball, volleyball, cricket, those kinds of sports. So I was there 2 years. You're probably getting the idea that I move around a bit. So 2 years, and then this PhD advert came up and I saw it, and I'd sort of, while I was in Doha, I'd sort of developed a passion, interest for research. We had a fair bit of spare time that we, you know, utilized doing our own little research projects and that kind of thing. And I kind of knew, you know, just with the way the industry's going, a PhD was probably going to be required at some point. Sorry, I forgot to mention, while I was actually in London, I did my master's via correspondence as well. So I came out with a master's degree after that 2 years there as well. But I'd always, I developed a passion for research through that master's program and through Doha, through Aspire Academy. And I kind of, as I said, I knew a PhD would probably be on the cards at some point, but I wasn't planning for it at that point. And it was actually the job description or the role description that interested me more. You know, I'd always, in all my roles, sort of been a one-man band type scenario, and I was really looking to develop my managerial skills. And what really invited me to this role, or what I really liked about this particular role, was obviously the research side of it was a bonus, but being a high performance manager in an elite pathway program, elite junior pathway program, with practitioners underneath me, that I could develop those managerial skills, and particularly working really closely with coaching staff as well in a new sport, and from a leadership perspective there. Those were skills that I wanted to develop moving forward. So that's what interested me most in the PhD. But in saying that, the research side has been incredible. I'm really lucky I chose a great topic. It's a really applied topic. Two and a bit years in, me and my wife are down in Bendigo in Victoria. I'd never been to Victoria, never been to Bendigo, neither of my wife. We sort of packed up and moved down here. Luckily, she could work remotely, which was excellent. And now she's working in the hospital system as well down in Melbourne. And I'm, two and a bit years in, basically in the writing phase of my PhD, and coming into my third pre-season with the Bendigo Pioneers as their high performance manager. Sorry, that was a long, very long-winded.
It's good. It's always good when I don't have to ask the follow-up questions. You answered the questions that came out the back, so it's all good.
Covered everything.
Yeah, definitely. So the, obviously, a lot of the audience we have will be based outside of Australia, and AFL being fairly unique, aside from the occasional international game against Ireland, is a mishmash of rules anyway. It's a sport that maybe people might have caught a glimpse on, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning in I don't know, the Ozbar in London, but it's not a sport you come across typically. So, I mean, obviously, you know, coming from a rugby background, you found yourself in AFL. But for those who are completely in the dark around AFL, give us a bit of an idiot's guide to what, when we talk about Australian rules footy, what are we talking about?
Oh, an idiot's guide. Well, my guide's probably going to be an idiot's guide anyway. So, yeah, I mean, everyone knows rugby. I guess the size, athleticism, strength component to rugby from a competitive, combative sort of nature. So if you relate that to AFL athletes, probably tone that down slightly. But the running component of AFL is out of this world. It's crazy. They're you know, across the park, they're aerobic beasts. And probably most relatable to Gaelic from over your way, Gaelic football. But, you know, coming from a rugby background, I love that combative nature of the sport. And, you know, I came into AFL wondering how combative it actually was. You know, I'd watched a fair bit of it on TV and that, but I'd always had this sort of misconception now that it wasn't that combative in nature. But, you know, working in the sport now, it is hugely intense. The, you know, 360 degree, I guess, impacts coming from all different angles, high speeds, the athletic nature of the players we deal with or athletes. So, as I said, they're highly aerobic in nature, but we got, you know, great speed and agility components, jump components within the game. And yeah, I guess what else is there to say about it?
Yeah, I remember the first time I saw some GPS stats on AFL, I couldn't believe it. I mean, like, we were talking high teens, early 20s in terms of kilometers of running, aren't we?
Yeah, we're generally talking, you know, ruckman sort of key position, the bigger players, they're generally around 10K in a game, but some of your midfielders, more nomadic players, you know, they can be up around 14, 15Ks in a game, easy. Yeah, so, you know, compare that to rugby and you're probably looking at what's 6 to 8K maybe in a game. So, as I said, highly aerobic, huge running component to the sport. And, you know, part of that is because of the huge field. So I think the field's about oval shape, but about 470 meters in circumference. So it's a large space to, as we're moving the ball up and down the field, you can understand how particularly those nomadic midfielders are covering a lot of ground up and back in offense and defense.
So give us a bit of an introduction then into, so you've come into this, the PhD role. What was the kind of remit for you as a researcher? Like, in terms of, was it fairly self-led in terms of an interest area? Was there a definite working title when you came in?
No, so it was very much self-led. It was a really interesting process. So there was sort of like there was a high performance focus to the PhD and the job application or the PhD application. So I obviously had to submit an application and I guess a research proposal. That actually didn't play out at all in terms of what I was thinking of then. So it was, was kind of come in, observe. So I came in mid-season, which was actually, has its pros and cons now, but came in mid-season and actually just spent the final sort of 4 months of the 2019 season just observing. and sort of really trying to develop that question, figure out the gaps, firstly in the literature, but also how I could, you know, help not just the Bendigo Pioneers, but the whole NAB League, the league-wide, and probably up and down the talent pathway as well. I saw a real gap there. So to answer your question, no, it wasn't a set title or objective that developed over time. Being a talent pathway, we call it sort of a development program, I was really lucky that we could have access to a lot of the data, league-wide data. So I didn't just have Bendigo Pioneers data. I had access to every Victorian-based team that competed in the NAB League. So that sort of having access to that data really sort of drove the aim, I guess, for me, was to promote information across the league that would help the development of these athletes, both up and down the talent pathway. So we see a lot of data, a lot of data-driven prescription and programming and performance within the AFL system and in the literature. There was a real gap that in the NAB League or elite juniors that are, you know, in that transition phase into the AFL, if you like, that we collect all this data, but not really doing anything with it apart from giving it to recruiters to do what they want to do. So that's sort of how it developed. From the Bendigo Pioneers standpoint, they sort of, again, they were looking for a high performance manager. So they linked up with the university and they set up this industry PhD where the Bendigo Pioneers and the AFL would contribute to the PhD stipend. So they've got to buy into the process, but they were really just looking for someone to take on that, someone with experience to take on that high performance manager role and really drive the performance side of the program that had been a little bit stagnant for a number of years. And, you know, they were typical programs at that sort of level. You're dealing with practitioners that are full-time generally in other roles. And, you know, the pioneers, whatever their role was there, would be their secondary role. So me coming in to do an industry PhD really set me up to be sort of a full-time high performance manager, which was what they were looking for. And allowed me to, you know, a lot more time to really drive the performance side of the program. Two sides and the Pioneers and the NAB League, that the remit there was really just from the delivery side of things. But then as that PhD question, I guess, developed over time, I figured out that I could influence across the league and up and down the talent pathway. And that's sort of how it developed. I don't know if that answered your question. But
yeah, sure. So forgive my ignorance. What does NAB stand for?
Sorry, NAB's the sponsor, NAB League, that's National Australia.
NAB League. Of course, National Australia Bank.
it used to be TAC Cup, TAC, which is the road insurance agency down here or something. I'm not too sure, but yeah, that's just the major sponsor. So essentially the NAB League is an under 18 competition and it's now sort of nationwide. It sort of started off more as a Victorian program, but we've now got some academy. So there's Sydney Swans Academy, there's Brisbane Lions Academy, there's GWS Academy, there's a Tasmanian team, and there's a Northern Territory team as well that sort of play in our comp as well. But it's an under 18 talent program. And basically, you know, the idea behind the NAB League is providing these players exposure to AFL recruiters. And the NAB League itself is one of the prominent, I guess, contributors to the AFL draft each year.
So, I mean, for those who obviously I haven't come across AFL before, operates, I guess, maybe the it's not a great comparison, but similar to the NFL draft, where players are kind of, you know, essentially put into a ranking kind of system, for clubs to potentially pick up new players. Out of interest, does the Father Son rule still apply in Australia in AFL?
It does, yes. Yep.
Yeah. So I think that's probably the only sport in the world where that rule exists. I've not come across that in another sport.
No, I haven't. And I don't actually understand how many, I guess, lineations it goes back either. So, I don't understand the rule too much. We've actually got a player within the Pioneers that comes under that rule for one of the clubs. A lot of the time it's providing, you know, those players with it's hard. It's kind of because there is that established connection there with the club. So from very early on, they have that established connection. So it can be a positive, or it can sometimes be a hindrance as well in their development. That's probably a story for another day. But yes, the father-son rule does still apply. And you're right in terms of the NFL sort of draft system. Yeah, so this, we call it a development league. It's not really about wins and losses. It's about developing the players and giving them an opportunity to compete in a nationwide sort of comp that AFL recruiters can go and see them playing. And they, as I said, we collect a lot of data as well that AFL clubs have access to. And then we hold the combine testing days as well. So very similar to the NFL system.
And I mean, essentially, I'm again an idiot's guide to AFL, but my understanding is the father-son rule is essentially, if your dad played for a club, they've got first dibs on you as a youth player. Is that correct?
I believe so, yeah. And I think it operates outside of the draft, rules. So teams will be allocated draft picks based on where they finished the previous season. But I believe it operates outside of that. Mm-hmm. So if they were to take a father-son player, it wouldn't impact their... I could be wrong here, but I'm pretty sure that's how it operates. It wouldn't impact their draft selections.
Mm. Nice. So obviously you've settled at the moment on a working title around match play demands and the characteristics associated with success in the draft. So talk us through the bit of the PhD journey, what that's looked like so far, what some of your results and findings have been.
Yeah, so it's been a really interesting journey. As I said, I'm really lucky. And for anyone out there that's going to embark on a PhD, my situation, even, you know, with the addition of COVID and all that as well, I'm in a really lucky position where I've had access to data. I haven't actually had to at any point go out and collect any additional data than I would already collect in my role within the Pioneers. And then obviously I get access to everyone else's within the NAB League. So from that perspective, my advice there, if I was to give anyone advice for a PhD moving forward, would be to try and pick a question or an aim where you have access to at least some data that's gonna help you get cracking straight away. And as we know in this post-COVID, well, it's not post-COVID, COVID world. I know of a lot of PhD students that have been hit really hard due to COVID, can't collect data. It's put them back, you know, years in their PhD journey. So from that perspective, I've been really lucky. As you said, there's sort of two streams to the PhD and how it's developed. The first one is utilizing the GPS data and that we've got access to to really establish what I noticed within the literature. As I said earlier, the AFL, there's a lot of literature on AFL match demands and less so at the NAB League level. And where that becomes really important is because, you know, these NAB League athletes are aspiring AFL athletes, and they're, you know, a lot of them, or a decent chunk of them, are going to transition into that AFL program, you know, following their NAB League playing career. And so we really need to understand the playing demands at NAB League level, firstly, so we're preparing them for NAB League level, but really key for me was preparing them for AFL or their AFL transition. So the first part was really establishing the elite junior playing demands from a GPS and technical perspective. So that's sort of one stream. And really what I'm trying to do there is just improve the knowledge within the NAB League so that we can, again, work up the talent pathway into the AFL, but that's also going to establish some really good benchmarks for those, you know, under 16 talent programs, under 15, and then even down to grassroots level footy within the country. You know, they've got something to work towards. So that's one side. The other side was utilizing all that data as well to try and establish some, I guess, associations with draft success. So, you know, development program, we want to get players drafted, players want to get drafted. We've got access to all this data. How can we utilize this data to try and or to try and establish what metrics or what combination of metrics or unique combinations of metrics are associated with draft success? So this has been done a little bit in the literature with different characteristics, but where we've sort of gone a little bit further is obviously league-wide data, but also we've combined physical testing data. So from the NAB League testing day, everyone gets tested in, it's like a combine essentially at the start of each season. So we've combined that data with GPS, in-game GPS data, and also in-game technical data from Champion Data, who is like the external stats provider for the AFL. So yeah, really looking at sort of position-specific unique combinations of metrics that can are associated with draft success. And then I guess the challenge at the moment is sort of tying those two stories together and how they're related from a PhD perspective. Obviously you got to tell a story, and for me the challenge at the moment is linking those two streams together, which we can do, but that's sort of the PhD component. The rest is me trying to, I guess, improve knowledge and influence training prescription within NAB League itself, but also hopefully, we might touch on that later, hopefully within the AFL system as well, of new drafted players or draftees coming into the transitioning into the AFL system.
Nice. So I'm guessing in terms of those metrics that are collected, I mean, obviously the simplest ones, things like total distance, high speed running, max speed, etc. I mean, would you collect something along the lines of impacts as well, or is that not a feature of the data?
We do collect it. It's not featuring in my PhD, and it's mainly through, so we use Catapult Systems, and they've got their player load metric, but also they've got some impact metrics as well. As I said, it's definitely an important component. And one that is probably becoming more and more important with the higher intensity, you know, as the game intensity increases, body size increases, athleticism, strength, power increases, it's definitely becoming more prominent. And also, you know, with things like, you know, the huge, I guess, discussions around concussion and that kind of stuff as well in sports. So those metrics do become important, but they're not featuring in my PhD. So I'm really looking at running metrics, and also, I guess, the exploration of some novel metrics that I believe can influence training better or influence the prescription of training better.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of those differences that you've picked up on between the senior level in terms of AFL and the under 18? What are some of the kind of stark contrasts that you've noticed?
Really interestingly, not a lot. So, you know, I think there's sort of this misconception, and well, maybe not a misconception, because some of the previous literature has highlighted some differences in running demands. So if we talk about running demands, previous literature has highlighted some differences in running demands from so if we go back to NAB League, our game durations are shorter than AFL, than the senior game. So we play 25-minute quarters straight, whereas AFL play 20 minutes on, but with injury time. So quite often their quarters can extend, you know, up close towards 30 minutes a quarter. Total distances, so absolute metrics, I guess. So any your total distance, total high speed running, total sprinting, any of those demands, accelerations, decelerations, are higher within the AFL system, purely based on greater game durations. But when we express everything relative to field time, there's really no difference between the two from a running demand perspective. So for me, that's a really interesting finding, and something that's sort of in contrast to previous literature. And I would suggest that's partly because the NAB League system's investing more in the high performance or developing the high performance component of their programs. So I guess from a really basic level, if we talk about the intensity of play of the two sports or the pace of play, in more layman terms, then they don't really differ too much at all. And in some cases, actually pace of play or intensity of play can, in the NAB League, can exceed that of AFL. And we put that down to probably lower skill level at NAB League. So I guess it can be a little bit more erratic in nature. But in terms of if we use meters per minute as an example, they are comparable. So for me, that's a really interesting finding in terms of, I guess I mentioned before, transitioning a NAB League player into the AFL. Traditionally, transitioning drafted players will be put on like a 1 to 3 or 1 to 4 year sort of transition program, where their exposure to AFL training is very gradual in nature. So obviously from a gym strength training perspective, and then a volume and intensity perspective on field as well. So it's very carefully managed. So when you think about it, we've got two training sessions a week with these players, and my mind goes, well, if we've got two training weeks a session with these players, and yes, they're doing outside training as well, but nothing like within an AFL system. If we've got two training sessions a week with these players for, you know, an hour and a half, some NAB League teams train more or less. We're traditionally on the lighter side, the lower duration side. We push intensity, and we can actually match AFL game intensities off 3 hours of training a week, face-to-face training a week. I start to ask questions around, you know, what volume of work is required at the AFL level, and do we need to, or could we put more emphasis on skill development and, you know, improving deficits and driving intensity of training? So that's one question. But the other thing is, you know, if players have been exposed to, and I'm not speaking for any particular AFL club here, this is sort of just, I guess, what you hear on the grapevine as to what happens for transitioning players. So volume, as I said, volume and intensity will be managed very, very heavily for a transition period of probably 1 to 3 years. So now I go, okay, well, if they've been exposed to AFL intensities of match play, running intensities, take collisions and that out of it, because you're dealing with bigger bodies at the AFL level, more developed players, but running intensities that are comparable, then for me, the management around a transitioning player would really be around total training volume. So I would be exposing them to as much match intensity, match simulation as possible, knowing that they can handle that level of intensity and pace of play. And then I would more manage around the total volume of training. So let them go from an intensity standpoint. Don't hold them back knowing they've been exposed to those intensities, but then manage the transition of total training volume over the course of the week or the preseason. That would so those are sort of the outcomes or I guess the questions I'm wanting people to start thinking about when they see the outcomes from my research.
That's interesting. So I'm just kind of reading between the lines here. So from what you're saying, it sounds a little bit like these guys are already getting an effective dose of training to meet the physical requirements to play the game, but the skill level is lacking. So when across that training week, maybe the focus needs to shift away from getting guys fit enough to play AFL from a physical perspective, but getting them good enough to play AFL. Is that right?
Yeah, potentially. I think they're, you know, from my perspective, I always want to drive performance and get them to the you know, to be the best they can possibly be. But in saying that, you know, with limited time, we can be, and I know if I, we've done some work with AFL Vic, I guess, and sort of looking at volumes of training that different NAB League teams do. And I think that the next PhD that comes in to take over from me is going to take this on even further, which will be really, really interesting. But looking at even within the NAB League, different volumes of training during the week. And as I said earlier, we traditionally sit on the lower side of training volume, but we really push training intensity through the GPS side of things and player feedback and a lot of coach feedback as well. And so we're always going to push that, but what that allows us to do is spend more time, you know, working on skill development. So, we're more worried, we're pushing intensity within drills. We're pushing, intensity, you know, transition between drills. In all honesty, this season, I reckon I could less than 10 times in this whole season just gone, I reckon we did structured conditioning sessions. And that was just because of this transition towards less volume in training, but really driving training intensity within drills. It's player-driven and coach-driven. And that got them, that was the previous season, that got these athletes to a level of condition we were really happy with at low volumes that we were sort of operating in NAB League at some of the highest work rates, highest intensities across the board. So that allowed us to really focus on skill development within training. And, you know, you hear sort of anecdotal stuff around where that some of the skill levels of AFL players from a kicking perspective and that might not be as good as they used to be. And I would say it's partly because of this really big high performance push that, you know, we're demanding more time in the limited time that we have. So I'm really, my philosophy is if we can get it done within drills and that, good. If not, I will top up, but I will top up with really high intensity work, not a heap of volume.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense actually when you're talking about it. I'm thinking about it in my context. So working in a rugby academy side of things, trying to prep guys for the pro level. And, you know, I'm fortunate to work alongside a coach who sounds very similar in that I don't do a lot of conditioning work with my players because we get, you know, looking at the GPS metrics, we get enough through what we're doing skill-wise. But it kind of, I guess, begs the question, how much volume is necessary, isn't it? Where, you know, if we can get guys fit enough doing the sessions we're already doing, then anything on top of that, it's actually just the unnecessary dose that's making them tired or potentially, you know, a bit injurious in terms of a risk. Whereas actually just saying, if we can back off on the intensity and invest that same amount of training time or training units into, you know, positional skills or technical skill development, that's going to be lower intensity, lower risk, but more meaningful potentially, because that's going to carry over to their exact position or their exact skill set. then longer term, in terms of the long-term development of that player, we're actually producing better quality players.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I'll use an example from NAB League. I talk about volume, our volume and intensity relationship. So we're low on the volume side, really high on the intensity. And I drive the intensity through some of those metrics, those novel metrics that I've found or been able to extract through my PhD. But I think the whole season we had two sessions above 9 kilometres in volume. Now that might seem a lot to some, but others in the AFL system, that's not much at all. And traditionally we would sit around 6 to 7K in a training session. So over the course of the week, we might average about 14K, 14 or 15K. I know there's other NAB League teams that, upwards of 20, 22, 23, 25 Ks at some points through pre-season. And we do this as a coach development tool. We collect this across the NAB League, and then we sort of discuss it as high performance managers, which is really good, which obviously doesn't happen at the AFL level, but us being a development league, it does. So, and then we look at in-game work rates or intensities, and we were consistently within the top two or three in the league, operating at half, two-thirds the training volume of some of the other NAB League teams. So straight away to me, like you're saying, if we can get an effective dose with half the volume, can we not spend our time better developing these players through, technical skill development or recovering? I mean, we're dealing with players that have school, they got exams, they got girlfriends, they got family lives, they, everything, they're getting their licenses, they want to do stuff. There's a lot going on in these young athletes' lives. Do we need the volume? And I would say no, we don't. Purely based off how we've approached things, and we've had success with that. But that's not to say my way's the only way.
That's really interesting. So let's dig into some of those novel metrics. I don't know how much you can reveal, but what's some of the things that you've kind of, I guess, pulled out as being maybe unique or your kind of take on things?
Yeah. So the biggest thing I'm looking at. One of the gaps in the literature, so if we talk about peak periods of demand or worst case scenarios, which I'm sure most people would have heard about, essentially what we're looking at is, identifying the period in the match, and I'm just talking running metrics here, so I'm not talking like a combination of metrics, I'm just talking running metrics, and particularly relative distance. So when we talk about a peak period of demand, we're sort of segmenting a match into use an example, 1 minute periods. And so that was the early technique. We'll segment 1 minute periods across the match or across the quarter. That method, I guess, sort of then evolved to use rolling windows. So if you talk about the GPS output, raw output, you've got a row, if you're using 10 hertz GPS, a row every 0.1 of a second. And the rolling 1 minute window just basically segments but rolls down each 10 of 0.1 of a second, if that makes sense. So it evolved from segmental to rolling, which was better able to sort of account for the undulation in running within that peak period. What that didn't do, or what that doesn't do to date, is it doesn't. So if we go, I'll use an example, the peak 1 minute period in a NAB League game might be 250 meters covered. What that doesn't do is it doesn't account for how that 250 meters occurred. So was that done at a moderate intensity, say, I can't do the maths off the top of my head, but say it was 4 meters per second for a minute, or was that done, 10 seconds of that 1 minute was done at 7.5 meters per second and the rest was done at 3 meters per second. It doesn't give us an indication of how that peak period, what it actually looked like. Hopefully that makes sense. So what I've been able to do and where we're sort of going now is identifying the distribution of velocity within that peak period. So if we, what we can do is within that 1 minute period, look at, break it down into the high speed running component and the low speed running component. You can really break it down into as many components as you like, just for simplicity. Low speed and high speed running. And then what we can do is look at the distribution and we can sort of, and I've used time windows from 5 seconds all the way up to 10 minutes. And we can look at how much time within those peak periods is spent high speed running. So for me, that's a really important component. The low speed running, particularly in AFL, it's not, I'm not worried about that. It's sort of incidental running. It's the high speed component that I'm more worried about. So what that allows us to do is then prescribe any prescribed training or even prescribed drills. We can start to ensure that we're sort of eliciting those velocity distribution demands within those peak periods, rather than traditional MAS type running, for example, will be a moderate intensity, fixed pace. Whereas what I'm trying to do now, particularly leading into season, don't get me wrong, I do use that steady pace MAS stuff, but I'm trying to prescribe undulating velocity within my MAS shuttles now that more match those that intensity distribution for those peak periods. And then if you think about from a skill or drill perspective, you might not use a minute peak period, for example. I'd use a minute peak period in my conditioning blocks, but you might use a five minute peak, look at the distribution of time spent high speed and low speed running in that 5 minutes. And then in your 5 minute drill, you're trying to elicit or replicate or exceed those within that 5 minute drill. So using that technique or method to identify the distribution of velocity within those peak periods. But then I've gone a step further. To me, the peak periods or a fixed time peak period is still missing some information. So it's still a minute, or it's still 30 seconds, or it's still 2 minutes. But my question is, what if the average intensity during that 1 minute actually goes for a minute 20 or a minute 15 or a minute 45, and your next biggest time window that you're looking at and averaging across is 2 minutes? So if it's a minute 20, then you're missing or you're diluting an extra 20 seconds of that intensity work into the 2 minute time window. Hopefully that makes sense. So you're missing a chunk, or you're missing I call it the true duration of a peak period. So what I'm looking at now is instead of a fixed window, I look at them in combination, but instead of a fixed window, I'm looking at identifying an intensity. So it might be 150 meters per minute, or it might be 200 meters per minute. They're the two that I'm using at the moment. And how long I'm looking at efforts above those intensities and how long they occur for. So an effort above 200 meters per minute might occur for obviously at least a minute, but it might occur for a minute and a half as an example. So then I would use that information in my programming to look at, or within my session, I would look at how many efforts occurred in the session above 200 meters per minute. And what was the percentage of time of my session spent above 200 meters per minute, and obviously relate that back to my match demands, which I've already established. Hopefully that makes sense. The other thing I'm using a lot, and I found this really, really helpful with the development of the coaches. So obviously a development league where we're developing coaches as well, is some of the work done by Rich Johnston up in Brisbane. They were looking at the distribution of game time spent at percentages of the peak 1 minute. So I'll break that down. You got the peak 1 minute period within a match, then you break that down into however many percentage bands you want to look at, and then you look at what percentage of game time was spent at those intensities. So I've used this really effectively with the coaches. So I've established what's the peak 1 minute in NAB League match demands, what that looks like as a curve on a graph. And then we try and replicate that curve within our training. So obviously our training duration is less, okay, but we want to replicate or exceed those percentages of time spent, particularly at the higher end of those peak match demands. And I've found this to be a really useful visual tool for coaches in combination with my percentage of time spent above 200 meters per minute to really drive their coaching. So early on, we had a lot of trouble with coaches overcoaching and spending too much time in transitions between drills. We're trying to drive intensity of training session. We got limited time. So we could visualize what that session looked like for them. So a bad session, I'd visualize and I'd say, you know, reflect on your coaching within this session. A good session, and we could see what they looked like, and we could reflect on how they coached during those sessions to really keep intensity high. Obviously, it comes down to drill selection and stuff as well. But for their development on not overcoaching, quick transitions between drills, sticking to drill timings and drill selection, we've sort of figured out what we need over the course of the season to replicate and exceed that those match demands within training.
Fantastic.
Long-winded answer, sorry.
No, it's great. I mean, what you're saying is golden. It's applicable to pretty much every invasion sport, right? It's essentially, are you training for the average demands or you're training for the peak demands? Because chances are the game-defining moments are not the ones that are happening. They're not averages. You know, they're not happening in the rest periods, are they? They're happening at the peak moments. And if you're not doing that, then you're essentially underpreparing your athletes for that. And I've seen that happen personally, you know, where clubs are training at a low intensity, doing lots of set piece things. And then, you know, when it comes to game day, they're just falling off the edge of a cliff because they're not prepped for what is actually the match defining moment, which is happening, as you say, in that worst case scenario, that peak demand. But also, you know, it reminds me of a conversation I had with John Goodwin, who's at Fulham Football Club. And he was talking about how they practice set pieces, you know, in within the club. And he said, you know, the coaches were kind of bringing up, we do so much practice of corner kicks, we do so much practice of free kicks, but on the game day, it never works. And they're saying, well, that's because when you do it in training, no one takes it seriously. You give them loads and loads of goes at it. So it's nothing like the pressure cooker of it happening in the actual game. And that's essentially what we're talking about is, you know, when you're training your athletes, are you reaching, or as you say, exceeding the worst case scenario? Because if you're not, then don't be surprised when your players aren't ready for it.
Yeah, they're not going to be prepared for it. And what we find is, you know, it's not just that peak 1 minute, it's also how much time is spent at and close to that peak period. You know, it's a long game in duration and it's an intense game in over the course of four periods. So you got to prepare for the peak, yes, but you've got to spend as much time as you can close to that peak as well. Because there's a lot of time within the game that's spent close to that as well. So you can't just, from my perspective, it can't be prepare for averages and peaks. It's prepare for everything in between, because that's the important stuff. Everything else is incidental to me. Everything in between average and peaks, and then above peaks and kind of gradually expose and expose them to peaks and time spent above peaks.
Brilliant. Well, I'm mindful of time, Jake, as I've already kept you for an hour or so. So we'll start wrapping things up. But obviously, you know, you're coming to the end of your PhD. What does the next 12 to 18 months look like for you?
Yeah, look, I'm hopeful to I'm hopeful to be in a professional environment within the next 12 months. That's the goal, at least. Ideally, that would be in an AFL setting. I'm loving the sport, and I would like to sort of carry on, I guess, and apply my research within the sport. As you say, though, you know, a lot of this stuff is pretty applicable to any team sport. So that's probably it. I've got a lot of writing. I've got 4 papers underway, and then the thesis to write, obviously. But yeah, other than that, I'm sort of gearing up for a pre-season with the Bendigo Pioneers again, and I'm also working with the Bendigo Spirit in the WNBL. So gearing up for a pre-season starting with them as well.
So fingers in a few pies.
Yeah, a few, yeah.
So where can people find out more about your research and follow your work? Is ResearchGate the best place? Is Twitter the best place? Where should people get signposted to?
Yeah, I don't do a lot on ResearchGate. Twitter's probably the best place. That's where I put most of my I guess work related, academic related work. So yeah, Twitter. Generally, I'm on there most days. Otherwise, LinkedIn, I tend to post a bit to there. Instagram and stuff, I sort of keep a bit more personal. Mm-hmm. So yeah, Twitter and LinkedIn, I would say, would be the best places.
And what's your Twitter handle if you remember it off the top of your head? If you don't, it's fine. I can link to it in the show notes.
Hold on, I got my phone here. Jake_Jennings1.
Lovely. Beautiful stuff. Well, mate, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you today and really good to hear about what you're doing. And I like what you're doing with the GPS stuff because I've heard a lot around worst case scenario, but what you're talking about with that distribution is taking it to another deeper level. And I think it makes a lot of sense. And I think I can see people seeing real value in that in, you know, pro settings. And as I say, not just in AFL, in rugby union, in rugby league, in soccer, and, you know, essentially any invasion game that's running based and varies in intensity, that's going to be the scenario. So I think, you know, people might listen to this and say, okay, that's AFL, but actually this is going to be true of every running based invasion game. So there's definitely principles that people can go away and have a little mull over, as you say, their training session. Are you giving too much feedback? You're too wordy with your responses. You know, I've definitely been in that scenario where coaches are given, okay, we're going to do a 60-second hot review. And I'm like, it's been 5 minutes.
Yeah, it hasn't even started after 60 seconds. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Well, mate, it's been a pleasure chatting to you today. And I really appreciate your time and thanks for sharing what you're doing with us.
Thanks very much, Rob. And thanks to James for getting me on here as well. So thanks a lot.
Don't forget, you can find us on Instagram using the account at LTAD Network, as well as Twitter at LTAD Network, and find our website, www.ltadnetwork.com. Thanks for listening to this episode. And don't forget to get your 7-day free trial to our online platform, as well as 50% off your first month with the code LTADVIP50.